main room of the club. I stayed at the other end of the table from Roy and ate in silence. I had taken Elizabeth to one side before the meal and asked her if there were to be any more shocks or sad news later in the day. "To be honest," I'd said, "I'm feeling really shaky. I don't know if I can deal with any more revelations." She looked at me kindly. "There will be some revelations," she began. I gasped and dropped my gaze to the ground. "But you'll be very pleased about them. Don't worry," she concluded. It's really hard to talk about being famous. We live in a society that is obsessed with it, that ranks it as the best thing you could possibly achieve in your life. I believe social media outlets like Facebook and Twitter are an absolute product of this obsession, as they partly manufacture how it feels to be famous for people who are not. You put personal information and images out into the world, and the more friends or followers you obtain, the less knowledge you have of who is watching or keeping track. It's great to feel popular, of course, but there is a downside. Even so, most people, and even friends who are close to you and privy to some of the more invasive aspects of fame, think the positive aspects far outweigh the negative, and you shouldn't grumble but thank your lucky stars when blessed by the fame fairy. And to a certain degree, they are right. Being famous is mostly great. I have a really amazing life. I get to do a job I really like and I get paid really well for it, and I am loved. Because I'm famous, I have a voice and I can help effect change. And I get loads of free stuff. But I am constantly self-conscious. Every day I spend large amounts of time meeting or talking to people I would rather not engage with. I sometimes fear for my physical safety. Let's leave it at that. In the run-up to filming Who Do You Think You Are, I thought how lucky I was to have at my disposal all these resources and teams of researchers to be able to give this gift to my mother of solving this family mystery. I said several times that this was in fact the best thing that had ever happened to me about being famous, and I truly meant it. But right now, it wasn't looking like the best thing anymore. Quite the reverse, in fact. I thought back to the telegram Granny had received. It was true, Tommy Darling had died in a shooting accident. I thought of the upset I was going to have to cause when I told my mother and my uncles what kind of accident it really was, and I wished at that moment that I'd never started this odyssey. I felt so selfish. This was my search, and now they would have to deal with the consequences. But then I thought of the other quest I'd been on just now. I thought about the lesson I'd taken away from my father's horrible chronicle and realised how important it is to be open, how the truth is all. And my Tommy Darling quest had been to find the truth as well. It was just that the truth was really painful right now. After lunch, I was driven into the actual village of Chaha, now no longer a village but a bustling little town with no indications of the perilous past its denizens once endured. I was to meet two local men who had known Tommy Darling. They were brothers named Datuk Rahman and Haji Ali, and they had been children at the time my grandfather had been here. Their father had been the head of the Malay community in Chaha then, and a very good friend of Tommy Darling's. As I walked up the path to their front door, I had a strange awareness that I was walking into a house that Tommy Darling had visited many times. I took my shoes off and left them on the porch before knocking on the screen door. Two little, grinning old men approached me, hands outstretched. Immediately, I felt safe. We sat in the cool of their living room, and they told me of their memories of my grandfather. "All the villagers at the time call him, in Malay, Tuan Darling. Tuan, in Malay, is Sir," said Datuk Rahman, smiling at me through his thick-lensed glasses. "Every morning he used to drive at 10 o'clock all the way around." His arm shot up and traced a circle above his head. "And then another in the afternoon, all around." Again he made the circle. "When he driving around, he see the children. Tuan Darling, Tuan Darling," we all cried. I could feel both the men's empathy for me, and also a sense of hope that indeed they had something to share with me that would soothe my pain. "I mean, the feeling of the people was they love him very much," Datuk Rahman continued. I wanted to know why the people of this town came to like Tommy Darling so much, especially since he was there only a short time before he died. "Well, he's the one who used to mix up all the gangs," said Datuk Rahman. "The leaders of the community, like my father, and a few others like the Chinese leader and Indian leader, They used to go together and have a good time, you know? They enjoyed drinking. So, Twan Darling liked a party and a wee drink. I could relate. Then I told the brothers that I'd learned today how my grandfather had died. Their smiles quickly faded and their heads bowed in respect. They told me how they had come to find out. It had been an extraordinarily hot day. There was a river at the edge of the village, still within what had been the perimeter fence, and they had gone there to swim, and had seen a man they knew to be my grandfather's assistant at the police station washing a bloody sheet in the water. They asked him what he was doing, and he told them it was the sheet that had been wrapped around the head of their precious Twan Darling as he was rushed to hospital in the vain attempt to save his life. I could see that after all these years, the vision of that bloody sheet still haunted these lovely old men. We sat in silence for a moment. "Your father was very close with my grandfather," I continued. "He must have been very upset." "Yes," nodded Haji Ali sadly. "Yes," agreed his brother. "That's why he himself put up the road name, the Darling." I was incredulous. They had named a road after my grandfather? I couldn't quite fathom exactly why I was getting so moved by a road sign, but I was. "Yes, Darling Walk," smiled Datuk Rahman. "Darling Walk," repeated his brother. "Darling Walk?" I asked again, as though I couldn't believe such a beautiful thing could have happened after all I'd heard today. "The local leaders here respect him. Very high respect," said Datuk Rahman very seriously. "He'd done a good job." I smiled at both the men and thanked them. They could not possibly know how much that last sentence resonated with me. All through my childhood, as I toiled my way through the exhaustive, insurmountable series of tasks my father would set me, I would dream that the conclusion of my work would be not the silent inspection followed by the inexorable spiral into anger and the force of his hand propelling me off balance. I dreamt that one day I would not be hit, and over his shoulder, as he walked away from me, I would hear my father say the words, "You did a good job." I felt connected to Tommy Darling in ways that went beyond our common lineage. We both lacked the same thing in our childhoods, the love of a father. For different reasons, of course, but it was a shared experience nonetheless. We both sought to fill that lack in our adult lives with family and love, as everyone does, but also with thrills and sometimes periods of recklessness. Luckily, I have always come back from my recklessness. Tommy Darling did not. But I also recognized restlessness in his spirit, a need to challenge himself that I too have experienced throughout my life. I wondered if I didn't have the job I have, which provides me with such thrilling, visceral release, would I be seeking those thrills in destructive ways? I know I love the rush of adrenaline pulsing through my veins. I wondered to what lengths I would go to experience it if I didn't do what I do. We left the brothers' house, and I walked with them into the centre of town, where I discovered there was not only a road named after Tommy Darling, but a park as well. The brothers proudly showed me the sign that said Darling Walk, and we walked along the little paved road round the Darling Walk Recreational Park. There was a kids' playground, trees, people strolling happily. It all seemed right. The horrifying news of this morning was tempered by these new revelations. To be able to tell my mum that all these years there had been a park and a road on the other side of the world bearing her father's name would be a sweet antidote to the shock of how he'd met his end. It actually seemed so fitting that even at the very end of his life, Tommy Darling touched those around him. He was a reckless man, inscrutable, but magnetic too. None of us had known that he'd gone to Buckingham Palace to receive his military medal, but he had. None of us, till now, knew that he was so beautifully memorialised, but he was. He had made a huge impression on these people. He was obviously a very charismatic man. Once we'd made our little stroll, the brothers took me to the exact spot where the shooting had actually happened. "This is the place," said Datuk Rahman soberly. "This is it," said Haji Ali. "The coffee shop is there," the first brother continued, pointing across the street to a little store. "They took the beer. Bring to this tent." He drew an imaginary line around the perimeter of the tent that had been set up in the town square 59 years ago. I pictured Tommy Darling and his cohorts finishing their patrol, getting a beer, and walking across the street for some shade in the tent. Then...
What? I didn't want to imagine the rest. Not here. Not as I stood on the very spot.
I looked around me. There was a little girl coming down the slide in the playground, and another clambering into a swing. It was lovely to see those children playing in the place where something so horrible had happened.
Your grandfather is a hero, you know. We respect him, very highly respect, said Datuk Raman, patting my arm gently with his hand.
I got in the car alone. The crew had to stay behind and I had a long trip back. I was glad to have the time to myself. I needed some time where nobody spoke to me and nobody showed me or told me anything monumental or life-changing. I was utterly drained. Thinking ahead, Elizabeth had made sure there was a bottle of wine in the back seat of the car. It was just what I needed. I said my goodbyes to the brothers, vowing to return one day with my mother to show her this memorial to the man they so revered. I opened the bottle and raised a glass to Darling Walk as it passed by me in the dusk. And then my thoughts returned to the man himself. The man who had lived life with the volume cranked way, way up. I felt filled with love and admiration for him. Here's to you, Tommy darling, I said, a little teary. You did a good job.
Thursday the 1st of July, 2010. The next day, I find myself in the Malaysian National Archives, a grand series of buildings nestled on a hill above Kuala Lumpur, where amid the hushed corridors I was told I would find documented proof to back up the revelations about my granddad's death. I was ushered into a grand library by a gentle lady named Gowri. She disappeared to find the relevant files while the crew sat up in silence. Today, I felt strangely calm. I knew the worst was over. I knew that the next day we would be flying to neighbouring Singapore to visit Tommy Darling's grave, but today felt like a buffer between the shock of yesterday and the finality of tomorrow. Gowri returned and gently placed a thick folder of documents in front of me. It was labelled L773, Lieutenant T. Darling. The first document I saw was a police telegram that detailed exactly the events of 22nd of June 1951. Darling and Police Lieutenant MacDonald returned to Chaha from patrol 12 noon, entered coffee shop for refreshment, and were joined by Assistant Resettlement Officer. Darling asked Assistant Resettlement Officer for loan of his 38 caliber revolver, took 5 rounds from chamber, leaving one, spun chamber, held revolver to head, behind ear, and pulled trigger. You will recognise this as old game called Russian roulette. Striker hit the single round, which discharged, killing Darling instantaneously. I let the thin piece of paper slip from my hands. Next, I saw some correspondence between the Malayan police force and my granny. Immediately, my stomach clenched, and I felt a lump in my throat. I thought of her, the laughing, joy-filled character who had always encouraged me to be naughty, to be reckless, to be myself. Now, I wondered if she'd seen something of her husband in the little boy she'd spoiled all those years ago. Dear Mrs. Darling, may I express to you on behalf of all ranks of the force our sincere sympathy in the sad loss of your husband. Thomas was handling a revolver and by an unfortunate mischance he fired a shot which caused his own instantaneous death. The letter went on to relay the particulars of his funeral, how many ceremonial shots had been fired, how many floral tributes. I kept looking at the paper and breathed in a deep, strengthening breath. Of course, they didn't tell my granny what really happened. How could they? I thought how sensitive it had been of them to have kept the true horror from her and her kids. Then I saw the next letter in the paper trail. It was from Granny. I recognised her handwriting from birthday cards and notes she sent me over the years. I have the last one she ever sent to me framed on my bookshelf, so I was very familiar with her penmanship. Dear Sir, about your inquiry as to how I would like to dispose of my husband's effects, I would like ever so much to get them sent home. My eyes began to fill with tears, and my throat closed up at the thought of her sitting down to write this letter, the very letter I held in my hands now. As the children would like something belonging to him as a keepsake, also myself, as we have nothing of his to remember him by. My poor, dear granny. The man she had loved, but with whom it hadn't worked out, had died on the other side of the world, and she had nothing palpable to make sense of it.
I thought of how the story of Tommy Darling's death had been passed down to me. Obviously, the vagueness of the Malayan police force's explanation had been slightly augmented or embellished over the years. I began to think back to the few occasions when it had been mentioned, and the variations I had heard. I also remembered the way the whole incident was referred to in slightly hushed tones, partly not to upset Granny, but also, as I now remembered, as there was a feeling of some wrongdoing on the authorities' behalf in the way Granny had been treated. Then I read a series of internal memos dealing with the issue of my grandfather's officer's pension, and eventually, after much to-ing and fro-ing and a desultory mention of the widow, I saw, to my horror, the ratification of the decision not to award my granny her rightful widow's pension, the pension that, though separated, Tommy Darling still wanted her to have. The reason they gave for withholding this lifeline to my family was that his death was not the way it was envisaged in some subsection of the Malayan police rulebook to merit it. Out of nowhere came memories of stories of my granny having to work so many jobs in the fields of the farms around where she and her four kids lived, scrabbling to get by, suddenly plunged into poverty after the support her husband had always provided her stopped overnight. There were a few more letters from Granny inquiring about the pension and when it would commence, and how she'd had to borrow money and also agree to a temporary loan from the state to cover her family's expenses. Then the letters stopped. She must have got the message. She realised the pension was not coming, if not the reason why. Anger bubbled up inside me. Tommy Darling had worked hard for his country all his life. He had risked his life many times. Indeed, it was a miracle he hadn't been killed in battle. Now, the very military system he had supported and upheld that had made him the man he was punishing him and his family for the results of the circumstances he had endured. For I had no doubt that the reason Tommy Darling blew his brains out in that tent that sunny morning nearly 60 years before was because of the trauma he had suffered on the fields of war. He was undiagnosed, untreated, but the man was ill. Still riled, I moved on to some correspondence from a year later with a letterhead from the police department in Elgin, a town near my granny's home in Scotland. Apparently, a sergeant from the station had been asked by the commissioner of police back in Malaya to go and interview Granny, perhaps because she'd moved and they couldn't contact her. He wrote, "I interviewed her there and she states that she is the widow of the police lieutenant who died in Malaya in 1951. Mrs. Darling added that a box containing her late husband's property has been lying at Liverpool docks for a year." I lifted my hand to my forehead, as if to keep inside the sadness I knew was bursting to get out at what I'd seen in the next part of the sentence. "As she is unable to pay the £4 carriage demanded." Tears ran down my face. I cried for my granny and my mum and every working-class woman who had sacrificed, like them, and been denied proper closure and emotional balm because they had slipped through the system. No, had been failed by the system and hadn't the means to do so. I blew out several breaths of sadness before I was eventually able to continue. "Oh, my poor little granny. That's so tragic." I dropped my head into my hands and just cried for a bit. All that I'd been through in the last 6 weeks, from that revelation on the roof in London to the bombshell of yesterday, converged in that library in an emotional dead end. And for all the horrors of Tommy Darling's story and the dredging up of the past the sudden re-entry of my father into my life had caused, it was this detail, this horribly human detail of a mere £4, that got to me the most. Life can be so fucking bleak, I thought. Imagine then how heartened I was to read the next letter, which recorded how the Malayan police had sent a postal order to my granny to pay for the shipping of the property. That was the least they could do. I've been thinking a lot lately about how a man I never knew, putting a gun to his head in a town on the other side of the world over 60 years ago, had such an impact on my attitude towards money, and in fact, the whole way I live my life. We all learn lessons from our parents, of course, and they from theirs. But perhaps more importantly, we glean our wisdom from our circumstances and our feelings of security, or lack thereof. Mary Darling was a girl of 13 when her life was turned upside down, sending her and her siblings into hard scrabble poverty. I think I learned from her that having money could never be guaranteed. It could disappear any moment, And so I've grown up wanting to feel secure when it comes to money, but doing so by treating it as something to be enjoyed, shared, and not given power. I guess I could have gone the other way and become one of those people who define themselves by their wealth. But I honestly believe that I have taken the knowledge that things can change in an instant and made it key to my philosophy of life. Neither money nor my work define me. I like them. They allow me to do many things I enjoy, but if I did not have them, I know I'd be able to find something else to do. I'd be able to survive. I could be happy. Sometimes the worst thing about change is the shock of the change itself and not actually the new circumstances. Perhaps because of Tommy Darling, genetically and through his legacy, I embrace change. I never take anything for granted, and I never forget how lucky I have been and am. Thursday the 1st of July 2010, evening. Later that day, we all went to the Colosseum Cafe. This was an old colonial hangout where military personnel travelling through Kuala Lumpur to their positions elsewhere in the country would have congregated. Again, I was in a place Tommy Darling would almost certainly have been. The bar didn't look like anything had changed much since his time. The yellow peeling walls were packed with pictures of military types in formal gear, as well as framed newspaper articles about various important issues to the clientele, like, when your servant has malaria. I got a beer and sat in the window watching the world go by as the crew set up, enjoying the feeling of nearness, thinking about how he might have sat here sipping a drink and looking out on this same street. My odyssey was nearly over, but I knew it would resonate with me for a very long time. I began to wonder how Tommy Darling would have fared in the present if he were a soldier now in Afghanistan or Iraq, how different his life would have been. I remembered the article I'd read in the middle of the night before, jet-lagged and fixated on his story and how to best couch it all to my mum. Although combat stress, or post-traumatic stress disorder, is now recognised by the military as a medical condition, there is still a huge amount of stigma attached to it by all sections of society, and there is no significantly successful treatment. Sadly, the article went on to say that suicide is the leading cause of death for members of the US Army today, which has seen its rates double since 2004. Maybe Tommy Darling wouldn't have fared so well today either. But as I downed the last of my beer, I determined to do something when I returned home. A fundraiser, some sort of memorial in Tommy's honour that would benefit a PTSD organisation in the hope that someone, somewhere, would get the help he never did. His death is not so shocking when you look at his life, I began when the crew was set up. Elizabeth asked if I felt I'd learned anything about myself. I stared into space and thought for a moment. Finding out about him and having to share that with my mum and my family has kind of reinforced my belief that it's really important to be honest and open and to have no skeletons in the closet. Because, you know, the truth can hurt, but not knowing can hurt more. I wasn't talking just of Tommy Darling, of course. The two parts of this story now seemed so clearly connected, mirroring each other perfectly. I had lost a father, but found a grandfather. One of them had never sought the truth and lived a life based on a lie. The other's truth was hidden from us because society deemed it unsuitable. Both caused strife and sadness. But now, both combined to reinforce for me what I knew to be the only truth. There is never shame in being open and honest. It was shame that prevented us from knowing what a great man Tommy Darling was. And it was shame that made my father treat me and Tom and my mum the way he did. All those years ago, lying in the grass of the forest at Panmure, I rejected shame instinctively. Now, my forefathers had reinforced for me how right I had been all along. Friday the 2nd of July 2010. The next day we made the short flight from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore and then drove to Kranji Cemetery where Tommy Darling was buried. As we walked through the large stone sentry gates that guard the grounds, I remembered how excited Mary Darling had sounded when I told her this was to be the conclusion of my journey, and I vowed I would walk through these gates again one day with her. There's a white, cross-shaped memorial in the centre, with a large tower reaching out from it, and just past there, and on to the right as far as you can walk, is where I found my grandfather's final resting place. I felt surprisingly happy. I'd not lost anyone. I'd found someone, and I was here to celebrate him. He was in a nice spot, under a big tree. I paid my respects, and it was all over. I said my emotional goodbyes to the crew at a restaurant before I was driven to the airport for the journey home. I was going to miss them. We'd been through a lot together, and I was grateful to them for the kindness they had shown me in a time of great need. I flew from Singapore to Tokyo and then had a few hours layover, and once more was able to indulge in my lounge worship. But even this swanky Air Nippon lounge couldn't quite lift me out of the numbness that had descended. It was now Saturday morning around 8 a.m. My body clock was all over the place. I was drinking a sake Bloody Mary. I'm very adaptable. And Skyping with my assistant who was at my house in the Catskills, preparing for the influx of friends who were coming up for the 4th of July holiday weekend. There, the time was 8 p.m. the night before. As much as I was looking forward to seeing Grant and my friends, I was a little apprehensive. I felt like one of those soldiers returning from the battlefield, a different man. I have a webcam on my house that looks out to the meadow and the rolling hills beyond. It's meant to be one of those security cameras that you face towards your house, but I like that it shows me what I look out at when I'm up there. If I feel needy of my life in the Catskills, it's only a couple of clicks away. You'd be amazed just how helpful and relaxing a few seconds staring at it on a computer screen can be. That Saturday morning, or Friday night, depending on your vantage point, I was able to watch my assistant and my friend Lance bouncing on the trampoline I have in the meadow. It was unreal to think that I would actually be there with them the following afternoon, or later that day. I was about to start one of those crazy journeys where I would arrive before I had departed. It was a good metaphor for how life felt for me around that time. Surreal. Out of control. Everything I had known as sure and true had been taken away, shaken up, and then recalibrated back into my life, and I was supposed to carry on regardless. I guess I had no choice. I knew I just needed to give it all time. Let it sink in. Let things settle, then reassess and see how I had changed. For the moment, I was going to have another sake Bloody Mary and a plate of edamame and then get on a plane and watch films with Sandra Bullock in them and cry. Part 3. Moving on. One of my favourite games is called Two Truths and a Lie. You say three things about yourself, two of which are true, one of which is a lie, and the other players have to decide which is the lie. Well, you can imagine how great it was to be able to add, I recently discovered my grandfather died in Malaysia playing Russian roulette, to my arsenal of truths. Or how about, my father recently told me I wasn't his son, but he was lying. All summer, I found myself telling the story to practically everyone in whose company I spent more than a few minutes. I could not stop thinking or talking about it. I knew that, as with any traumatic happening, it was important to give it weight, to acknowledge the effect it must be having on me, and to use the talking about it as a way to cleanse my system. That way, I would eventually be able to create some distance, and therefore, some objectivity. That's the idea, anyway. It's a bit like when you break up with someone and you can't stop talking about them until you get them out of your system. Though, of course, having known many friends who suffered from compulsive breakup talking syndrome, and unfortunately having suffered from it myself more than a few times, I knew the danger was that my compulsive familial bombshell talking syndrome could oh so quickly and easily develop into boring old fart who just can't seem to move on syndrome. Although I'm joking, there were some similarities between my story and dealing with an ex, or to be precise, dealing with two exes. My father was now definitively out of my life. I would never talk to him again. My grandfather, too, was gone just as quickly and dramatically as he had appeared. Both of them left many unanswered questions behind. Both were charismatic men with strong personalities, and both had left their imprint on me on every level, emotionally, spiritually, genetically. Because of their absence, I was a changed man, and talking about them and telling the story of my insane summer was my way of trying to realign myself and clear a path through the wreckage they had left behind them so I could move on. I went back into therapy. One of the annoying things about starting with a new therapist, I have discovered over the years, is that you have to bring them up to speed on a lifetime's worth of your stories, and that can be quite time-consuming.
But actually, considering the magnitude of what I'd just been through, it was a good and useful exercise for me to go back through my childhood and early life and give it more context. Still took a while, though. After a couple of months, I said to my therapist at the end of a session, "I don't know why I'm here." "What do you mean?" she said, her face at once inquisitive and perfectly calm. "Well, I mean, I know why I'm here, of course. I've just had a huge fucking crazy lot of shit happen to me. But aside from that, I sort of feel there's some other reason why I've needed to come and see you. And I'm just not sure what it is." I looked at one of the many clocks in the room. My time was up. I began to gather my things. After a moment, she replied, "I think you're coming here because you know your father is dying and you want to make your peace with him." I felt like I'd been slapped across the face. It was so obvious and so right. That was exactly what I was doing. "Yes," I said softly. "I think you're right." I went home and bawled my eyes out. The date of the broadcast of my episode of Who Do You Think You Are approached. Because of filming in New York, I wasn't going to be able to watch it on the BBC with my mum as I'd hoped. But we were both sent a DVD. It lay in my bag for days before I had the courage to watch it. It felt like I was taking a chance on opening up a wound that had only just healed. And it certainly didn't pull any punches. There I was, receiving the news that my grandparents had separated, that Tommy Darling's medical records had been removed due to the psychological damage he'd suffered, and eventually, of course, the gory and shocking details of the Russian roulette. It was so strange to feel sorry for myself. The few months since, combined with the change in my physical appearance, my body hair had grown back in, I no longer resembled the pale, hairless man-child on the screen, had ensured that there was a healthy distance between the me then and the me now, so I could empathise with as well as relive the experience. Also, there was the experience of seeing myself completely off guard. Even in a show like this, where one is supposedly ignoring the cameras and the viewer is a fly on the wall, there's always, of course, some awareness of being filmed. Several times on my episode, all that was stripped away as I received information that completely floored me. I saw myself as I never truly have seen myself on screen before, completely unadulterated, vulnerable, and authentic. It was fascinating, but not very pleasant. I could tell Mum was very anxious about the show being broadcast. It's easy to forget how exposing being on television can feel at the best of times to people who aren't used to it, but having very personal details of your parents revealed publicly was something she had no experience of whatsoever. In the end, Mary Darling decided she wanted to watch the show alone, and spent the rest of the evening answering her phone, which was ringing off the hook with people from all parts of her life wanting to speak to her about what they'd just witnessed. For the next few months, people contacted her constantly about Tommy Darling's story. Some she knew, others were strangers who had known him or known my granny. I think it was good for her. Much in the same way that I felt I had to keep telling my dual family narrative, she was able to talk it out in this way and was also fascinated to find out more details about the father she never knew. She has since met several relations from her father's family and continues to explore both sides of her family tree, armed with all the initial research that was done for the show before they realised my grandfather's story was the one to focus on. I delivered to her two large binders bursting with documents, and she has had a field day with them. I began to look into PTSD organisations with a view to arranging a charity screening of the programme in honour of my grandfather. I discovered one called Give an Hour that I decided to contact. The premise of this group was that mental health professionals would give free hourly increments of mental health services to returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and then in turn the people who received this free care would give an hour of their time to some form of community service. I liked the way it was so simple and straight to the heart of the problem, and also that the veterans who were receiving the care were also able to give something back in return. I hoped that in some small way, I'd be able to help some people in need, ensuring that they were given the professional psychological care that was never available to my granddad. But that wasn't the only reason. I didn't quite know it at the time, but now I understand that this event was a gesture to my father, too. The more I've talked about him and what happened in my past with both friends and mental health professionals, the more I've come to believe that he too suffered from some undiagnosed mental condition. It's not just his violence, his volatility and mood swings. It's his complete lack of empathy, his seemingly utter inability to consider the feelings of anyone else. And of course, my dealings with him over the course of that summer only underscore this.
I was not talking to a sane man in those phone calls. There was a disconnect and an egotism that were at times breathtaking. His insistence that I must have known I was not his son all along. His question, did you not notice we never bonded? And worst of all, the utter absence of an apology or any hint that he understood what he had put me through when I eventually was the one to break the truth to him. All these things regularly float through my mind and convince me of his madness. I am not a psychologist, though I've spent a lot of time in their company. And although I have speculated about what exactly my father's condition or conditions might have been, I'm weary of it all. Weary of the wondering. This much I know. The benefit screening I held at the Tribeca Grand Hotel on Sunday the 7th of November 2010 was a gesture to both Tommy Darling and Alec Cumming. This past summer has been really difficult for me, and so tonight is in some way a form of closure, I'd said in my speech before the programme was screened. I had no idea just how much closure. The next day I woke up to the news that my father had died that night. Thursday the 17th of February 2011. Once a year, I go to Boston to record the introductions for Masterpiece Mystery just to annoy Patti Smith. It's a fun annual jaunt. My assistant and my friend Michael, the groomer, had come up with me on the train from New York the afternoon before. That evening we had dinner with my old chum John Tiffany, who was doing a sabbatical at Harvard and so living in Boston at the time. John had directed me in the back eye for the National Theatre of Scotland. Soon, we would begin work on our next project together, Macbeth. After much mirth and a chilly walk back to the hotel in the snow, we were up bright and early the next day and at the WGBH studios to start shooting. I was sitting in the makeup chair checking my emails when I saw one from my brother. Hi Alan, hope all is well. See the attached which you need to respond to. That's odd, I thought. Tom wasn't usually so enigmatic. But then I opened up the attachment and I saw why. Our father had once more, even from beyond the grave, entered our lives. It was a letter to Tom from our father's solicitor. My heart was thumping as I read it. The title in bold was, Your Late Father's Estate. The man introduced himself as the person who'd been dealing with the winding up of the estate and said he was writing with regard to our potential legal rights claim. I made as if to speak, but the whir of Michael's hairdryer filled my ears, and anyway, I didn't quite know what to say. I had no idea what this could possibly mean. On the one hand, I felt like I was suddenly a living manifestation of one of the plots of the mystery shows I was about to introduce, and on the other, I just couldn't believe that my father was still able to exert such an influence. He was the embodiment of those buried minds left long after a conflict had ended that occasionally erupt, and the pain of the past as well as the carnage of the present combine in a perfect storm. As you know, your father left a will in which neither yourself or your brother Alan was bequeathed any items. The idea that my father would have left anything to us had never crossed my mind, though I had wondered if I would ever receive that letter he had spoken of, the one that originally would have been the harbinger of my true lineage. In the intervening months, I had often thought how lucky I had been to have had the chance to talk to him and get to the bottom of all this whilst he was still alive, rather than be presented with a letter after his death. The idea that I would never have had the chance to question him, challenge him, and of course be able to tell him he was wrong, was completely inconceivable to me now. Under the terms of Scots law, you are entitled to a share of your late father's estate, irrespective of his will. This share is called legal rights. What? Irrespective of his will? Scotland has a law that overrules a father's will? Legal rights are calculated by taking the net movable estate, the movable estate excludes any property such as houses or flats, and dividing it into two. One half share is made over under the terms of the will, and the second half forms what is known as the legitim or bairn's part. It was all starting to come clear. Bairns is a Scottish word for children. Basically, my country, at some point in its history, saw fit to enact a law to stop errant fathers from not providing for their offspring after their own death. It is this share that is then divided between the number of children. In your father's case, it would be divided between you and your brother Alan. Over the next few days, my brother and I were thrown into yet another tailspin of my father's doing. We swung between thinking we should take the money. It was ours, after all, legally. And then thinking that by taking it, we would in some way be accepting blood money. We truly felt that passionately and extremely about it. It wasn't about the money, though obviously that was a nice surprise. It was more the feeling of being beholden to someone we did not respect, who had made it clear he did not respect or love us. Both of us were so riled that we were so riled, and we knew our father would have loved to think of us spending so much time agonising over an edict of his. Eventually, I spoke to the solicitor. "We haven't decided exactly what to do yet, but I wanted to ask you a couple of questions to clear a few things up," I began. "Fire away," he replied. "Did my father know that this would be the outcome of his will? I mean, would he have been told about this?" I asked. "Absolutely," the lawyer said unequivocally. "He would have been told about the legal rights issue when he made his will." "And so, even though he knew that we were entitled to half his financial estate, he still made a decision to not name us?" I was incredulous and couldn't bear to think where this conversation was going. "That is correct," the lawyer said. "So he decided to actively keep us out of his written will in order that we would have to make the decision to take the money that was legally due us?" I responded. "That would appear to be the case," came the reply. I then called my father a name that I rarely use and do not approve of, but in this case was the only appropriate moniker for such a loaded and manipulative and cowardly gesture. So basically, my dad wanted my brother and me to be having the dilemma we were having right now. It was one last blow to our hearts, one last fuck with our heads. I could see my father's face as he was told the ramifications of making his will as he did. I saw him thinking of Tom and me being made to question and struggle and suffer as we interpreted his actions, and enjoying the prospect of us doing so. That was it for me. After a short chat with Tom, I called back the solicitor and told him we were taking the money. I was calling the old bastard's bluff. I wanted him to be the provider, finally, of something positive in our lives. I wanted to use the cash to do something as a family that would be happy and meaningful and positive, and I knew exactly what that would be. 2 years later. Me, Grant, Tom and his wife Sonia, and Mary Darling made what I suppose can only be called a pilgrimage to Malaysia and retraced both my and Tommy Darling's steps. We flew from London, and even after a 7-hour layover in Abu Dhabi, we arrived, not exhausted, but refreshed and lean, as we had slept the sleep of champions in our first-class pods and had massages in the lounges of both our ports of call. I could see, watching Mary Darling, where I got my lounge addiction from. We had a driver, Hairi, who'd been on the Who Do You Think You Are shoot, and were helped by Alan de Cruz, who had been the show's fixer, as it's called in filmy circles. The first night, we met up with Alan for drinks at the Coliseum Cafe, and I could see the gleam in my mother's eyes as she sat having a drink and imagining she was in a bar where her father had once been. The next day, we went to the Malaysian archives and were shown to a private room by the lovely Gowri. We pored over the correspondence detailing Tommy Darling's death and the ensuing stream of letters back and forth to Granny. Tom, Mum and I all marvelled at the idea of seeing Granny's handwriting in a little room of an archive on the other side of the world. We found out more about Tommy Darling's life there, and again, it was wonderful to see my mum so engaged with our father's legacy. The next day we went down south towards Chaha, and I knew to a part of the trip that might be very painful for my mother. I needn't have worried. As we turned the corner into the street where Datuk Rahman and Raji Ali lived, I was shocked to see it so busy. Car after car was parked all around the house, and I saw a marquee and crowds of people all waving at us. I realised that these two little old men had got out the bunting, quite literally, for the arrival of the daughter of Tuan Darling. The whole town seemed to have stopped. All the elders of the village were gathered for a feast at the brothers' home, and Mary Darling was the guest of honour. If she had not understood the magnetism and the legacy of her father, she must now, surrounded by people who, for the most part, had never known him, but who had felt his influence and his charisma in the very fabric of their lives. After lunch, we went to the town square, walked along Darling Walk and sat in Darling Recreational Park. The brothers told Mary Darling the details they had told me of that morning in 1951. I could see her try to maintain her composure. As fascinating and revelatory as all this was, and as kind and beautiful as these men were, she was still the little girl finally understanding where her father had been. At one point they wanted to take a picture of her at the very spot where he had shot himself. I could see her steel herself for it, not wishing to appear rude, but I could also instantly tell the toll it was taking just imagining the horror.
"Are you okay, Mum?" I asked.
"Yes," she gulped unconvincingly.
"You don't have to take the picture if you don't want to."
She signalled to me she didn't, and I subtly but firmly broke the moment. At a market, I admonished my mum for constantly running off and then made her promise to tell us if she was going to go to a stall in another direction.
"I'm worried I'm going to lose you, Mum," I'd said,
and let it hang in the air for a moment before she nodded, and we both knew that something had altered forever. It was as though Tommy Darling hung over us, and we were all made aware of the frailty of life, the importance of family, and the power of love. Eventually, we drove to Singapore, and it was there, after we all visited his grave, that I heard my mother say something that made my heart fly. It made me take heart to hear that I'd done a good job in arranging this trip, but more importantly, that doing this TV show, in fact, being famous, was all worth it. I'd walked away from the grave and gone to stand under the nearby tree to take a video of everyone else leaving. I was shooting Grant and Mary Darling as they walked towards me, and just before they left my frame, I heard my mother say, "Well, they say dreams do come true." When we arrived back in New York, Grant made an observation. "You know the best thing about this whole trip?" he asked.
"What?"
I replied. "Your father wasn't mentioned once." And it was true. We none of us ever mentioned him at all. Not through some desire to expunge him from this experience, not because we felt awkward that he was inadvertently paying for this amazing odyssey. No, none of that. We just didn't think of him. He wasn't that important to us. He no longer had any power over us. Part 4. Postscript. That was supposed to be the end, you know. Under that tree, beneath a cloudless Singaporean sky, with Mary Darling walking past me saying her dream had come true, with a man I love accompanying her and my amazing brother and sister-in-law following them. That was supposed to be the end of this book. Then, about 8 months later, just after Christmas 2012, Jack, my mum's companion for 25 years, died after a long illness. Grant and I flew to Scotland for the funeral. The night before the funeral, we all stayed over at Mary Darling's, me, Grant and Tom. At dinner, I said that on our way back from Forfar, where Jack's funeral was, I'd like to go to Palmyre Estate, have a drive around, and show Grant where I'd grown up. I knew that over the years the estate had ceased to operate as I had known it. The farms and the plantations were divided up, the sawmill closed down, and the various workers' houses were sold off to whoever wanted them. We entered from the east gates, late afternoon sun throwing long shadows of the leafless trees across our faces like a strobe machine. It was so beautiful. I realised I had grown up in spectacular beauty, but I hadn't noticed. I suppose my mind was elsewhere. We drove the route that Tom and I had walked on that last visit with our father 19 years before. We stopped at the bridge, and I hopped out of the car and ran the path along the top of the cliff, though it's too leafy and sloping to really call a cliff. I arrived at the stone engagement seat that some earl or other had built at some point for his fiancée to sit on during their courting walks through the forest. Grant ran behind me, trying to keep up, snapping away with his camera. I felt so free. Isn't that funny? I felt at home and happy. This was not an emotion I'd ever expected to feel that day. The drives, once pristine and manicured, were now rowdy and overgrown. As we drove down through the sawmill yard towards the house, the walk I'd feared twice every school day, I gasped repeatedly. Everything had been knocked down. The sawmill was just a pillaged skeleton. The tractor shed, a concrete square with weeds growing up through it. I felt the absence of my father. He was order and neatness and spit and polish. This was utterly decrepit. He was gone. And so I felt able to observe my childhood home like I would a box of old photos I chanced upon in a cupboard. The house was empty, but locked, of course. It had apparently recently been purchased.
A weekend home for some wealthy family, most likely. It still felt big. I'd expected to find it less daunting now, but no. It was still bleak and menacing. We walked round the unkempt garden and looked in the windows. It was just as I remembered it. There was the sink. The kitchen rearranged a bit, but much the same. Just a kitchen and a big stone house in the Angus countryside. I saw the wee room off the living room where I'd played the piano. The good room that we'd literally spent a handful of evenings in all year. As I turned the corner into the house driveway, I caught a glimpse of the silhouette of my father through the neck curtain of the office window. My heart skipped a beat and I stopped. Grant later told me how in the woods I'd run and leapt on stones and over fallen trees, but the closer we got to the house, the slower I became and more measured. Of course, the woods meant freedom to me, air and imagination and being unobserved. The house was all darkness and silence and expecting the worst. My hand was on the doorknob to the shed. I turned it open and walked inside. This was where, more than 30 years before, my irrational and irate father had held me down and clipped my hair with sheep shears. I took in every crack of the stone floor, every nail banged into the crumbling plaster of the walls, until my gaze rested on what I realised was my reflection through the cobwebs in the window. I smiled. If my father had been alive, I think he would probably have been quite proud of me right now. I was wearing a tailored black suit, white shirt and slim black tie, black brogues, my hair well cut and groomed. Even my glasses were clean. I think my father would have approved of me. I think I would have finally passed his test. But I had come back here, dressed like this, out of respect for Jack, not my father. It didn't matter what he thought anyway. I thought I looked just fine. Acknowledgements. Jason Weinberg completely managed this whole thing, I now realise. Luckily, he is my manager. It was he who got me to sit down with Luke Janklow in the cafe of the Standard Hotel in West Hollywood late one afternoon during a week of night shoots on a movie in the summer of 2011, much against my will, I might add. Then Luke was the one who completely surprised me by not exhorting me to do a My Fabulous Celebrity Life type of book, but to write about something I really felt passionate about. Luckily, Luke is my agent. Through Luke, I met Carrie Thornton, who encouraged me to go deeper and darker and to trust that my story was good enough. Luckily, Carrie is my editor. I owe such a huge debt to all three. If my childhood had been pleasant and uneventful, then even if in middle age Tommy Darling's story had been suddenly sprung on me as it was, I probably wouldn't have written a book. My family would have all gathered round the parental home's TV and watched the shocking tale unfold, and then I'd be pulled into the collective bosom and we'd all cry happy tears, and that would have been that. Since it wasn't that way, and I did write this book, I suppose the next person I really should thank is my father. Thank you, Alec Cumming, for siring me and ensuring I will always have lots of source material. I forgive you. Thank you more, though, to Tommy Darling, for your patience, for waiting so many years for us to find you and for your story to be told. I wish I'd known you. I hope I've demonstrated how much I appreciate and adore my mother, Mary Darling, and my brother, Tom, with every fibre of my being. And if, as I suspect, Grant Schaefer actually is an alien from the planet Kindness, I will not be surprised. I will willingly give up these earthly delights and accompany him back there on the mothership. To all my dear friends who listen to this story or to me telling it to others over the many months, nay, years, that it has taken for me to finally feel I am done with it, thank you. Finally, the scariest thing about abuse of any shape or form is, in my opinion, not the abuse itself, but that if it continues, it can begin to feel commonplace and eventually acceptable. Writing this book and knowing it will be discussed around the world is in some way insurance for me that my story will never be thought of as commonplace, never acceptable. And for that, I thank my publishers and everyone involved with making it happen from the bottom of my heart. Alan Cumming, New York City, 2014. This is Alan Cumming.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged recording of Not My Father's Son by Alan Cumming. This programme was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Erin Wicks. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Recorded by Charles de Montebello. Text copyright 2014 by Alan Cumming. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.